Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi, the show that dives deep into global foreign policy and international relations to examine their methods and patterns and its history that reverberates in our lives today. Today, we will examine the wave of protests that have swept across Iran in the fall of 2022 following the death of a young woman in police custody. These protests, however, looking a lot different from protests in the past. Woman-led and garnering global interest. Is this an organic movement or a color revolution in disguise? We'll discuss. All right, let's get into the MO. In the U.S., the women's movement led to a series of sweeping change in laws across the country. For close to a century now, women in America have taken to the streets to wear pants, to have the right to vote, to divorce, to drive, have agency over their own bodies. Now, recent years saw American women don pink knitted caps as a show of solidarity for women's rights. Meanwhile, in Iran, the women are taking off their headscarves, known as a hijab in the Muslim world. Now, it's a show of solidarity for their own women's movement, triggered by the mysterious death of a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini, who was taken into custody by the so-called morality police of Iran for improper wear of her hijab. Now, facts surrounding the case are spotty at best. Iranian officials say she died from pre-existing health problems. Her family alleges the police beat her to death. Now, the video released from police in Iran only show her from the back, briefly, before she suddenly collapses. While her death is tragic, no matter the cause, what followed in Iran is what's in question. Now, let's be clear about one thing. To question whether or not there was any external influence to what we witnessed in Iran does not imply support for that government, nor does it diminish the desire for social change many Iranian women wish to see. Anti-imperialism does not mean pro-theocracy. To question what we see in Iran or anywhere else for that matter is simply foundational to what defines traditional journalism. And that's what we are aiming to do here. One of the tropes that came from these Mahsa Amini protests is that the hijab is oppressive to women. And that's just one of the angles we'll discuss with our guest. She's a lecturer at Lebanese International University and Maarif University, also the producer and host of a political talk show called The Mideast Stream on Press TV. Dr. Marwa Osman is joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon. Dr. Osman, first, we are seeing protests in Iran that appear to be female-led. It began as anger over Mahsa Amini's death, but then it sort of evolved into something bigger, something more broad. We're seeing hijabs being taken off in public. They're being burnt. I've seen women giving speeches on top of cars while they're topless. Women have gone as far as to publicly cut off their hair in protest. Do you believe the outrage by these women and calls for social reform in Iran is organic, or is some of what we're seeing being egged on from external sources?
Well, let us begin by saying that any group of people in any community has the right to protest as long as the protest is a peaceful one that doesn't include riots, that doesn't include a smashing of public property and basically putting the security of the public at risk. That should happen anywhere, and I'm an advocate of that. But when any sort of protest, no matter what the demands are, turn into a violent one that tends to attack security forces who have no weapons in Iran. The police in Iran is not similar to the police that you see. It's not like the NYPD or any other PD that there is in the US, for example. They don't carry guns. They're actually, they carry just batons, and they, because usually it's not that violent on the streets of Iran, whether it's in Tehran or any other province. But to come to a point where the throats of the security forces are slit and security cars are lit on fire, where arson takes place in certain communities, in certain precincts, police stations, even the homes of the civilians that are near police stations were stricken by these arsons and by these attacks. When this protest becomes a riot that has nothing to do with civil liberties and demands of rights, whether for women, men, whoever it is, everyone's part of the community, everyone has basically a right to demand from any authority, from any regime, for their rights to be met. But if public security is being threatened, if the police officers are being killed, if ammunitions are found, if weapons are being smuggled from the Kurdish part of Iraq to the Kurdish part of Iran, where basically the violence was taking place, then this has no more say whether it is a local or an international instigated protest. This is basically something created, whether by embassies found in Iran or that are still allowed to be in Iran because of the sanctions and because of the basically suffocating Iran since 1979, or whether it is from a regional and Western governments that are instigating these riots and these this wrecking havoc, if you will, in Iranian peaceful communities. When it becomes weaponized, when you see ammunition, when you see insurgents being basically taken, transported from the Iraqi side to the Iranian side with the sole goal of seeing Iran lit, seeing the streets of Iran on fire, seeing the public in Iran put under dire threat, then this is no longer a question of civil liberties. It is now a question of a color revolution being fully supported and aided and abetted and funded by Western governments, especially those that voice their concern, and they voice it by funding programs to ignite the streets of sovereign states like Iran.
The U.S. has long had a contentious relationship with Iran, to say the least. We saw under President Trump, his administration operated on the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. He withdrew unilaterally from the JCPOA. That was, one of the legacies of the Obama administration. Biden was VP at the time. Now he is POTUS himself. Do you see any meaningful differences between Trump and Biden when it comes to Iran?
Well, I would answer with a question. Did you see any differences when it comes to Iraq, when it comes to Somalia, when it comes to Yemen, when it comes to the other, I just mentioned three of the seven illegal wars that the U.S. is directly involved in across the world? And I say illegal according to the American law, because the American law, it says that no war, that the U.S. cannot enter any war without the approval of Congress. Congress never approved any of these laws, so it's illegal according to the American Constitution. But according to the law of the international community, to the international law, everything that the U.S. has been doing is against international law. Whether it is against Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, Yemen, you name it. I mean, there's history and you could just find it everywhere you look. But when it comes to the relationship with Iran, since 1959 up until now, has the relationship between the US and Cuba ever changed? No, because the government in Cuba is adamant on fighting imperialism and fighting anything that comes against its sovereign state. The same thing goes for Iran. Before the 1979 revolution, Iran was a very good friend to the U.S. Actually, it was a puppet government for the U.S. because of the coup against Mossadegh that happened in the 50s. But when the Shah came to power, he basically was a puppet regime in the hands of the United States and in the hands of the Zionist entity as well, known as Israel. They had no problem with it. The only problem that they had was a revolution, a powerful, public, popular revolution that happened in Iran, led by Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini. And the people said their word. They stood by their word. They fought against the army that was shooting live bullets and killing hundreds of thousands of them without them having any weapons, because no one dared to come in and help. No one helped the Iranians during their revolution. The Iranians helped the Iranians during their revolution. And that's why it's a solid revolution, because it is by the people, for the people. But what changes had the Obama did accept the JCPOA that did not even commit to the terms of the JCPOA during Obama times, not even before Trump came to power? Because if you remember well, there was one of the terms of that agreement that Iran would get, would be allowed to buy spare parts from Boeing for its line and fleet of airplanes, civilian airplanes, to maintain their safety and the safety of the passengers. That never happened. Also part of the agreement was to release Iranian money being held, basically pirated, inside the United States of America. That didn't happen. And when Trump came along, he just didn't like it because he was pushed and bullied by the Zionist entity, and he decided to leave it, just like he left many other treaties. He didn't. He even had a fight with your own bordering Canadians, who never have a fight with anyone, but he also picked a fight with them. But and I don't think any possible upcoming, whether candidate or in office, president in the United States of America will change that, because it's not up to the person sitting in that office. That's just, excuse my language, but that's just up for show. It's the president in the United States of America is not really running the show. There are other people who are never changing their position. I mean, you always see a president being changed every 4 or 8 years in America. But when was the last time the head of the CIA was changed in America, or the head of the FBI, or the head of other deep state institutions in the United States of America? That's the real question. Who is really running the show in the United States of America? Are they in public offices? Of course not. They're not in public offices, just like it's the case in every other country. The people ruling the country are not the people who go on TV. They are the people who are running the economy. They are the people who are running the military industrial complex in that country, whether the United States or any other country, but specifically the United States of America, because it is an empire with the real definition of the term. So no, I don't think it's different. I think it's the same. It's just a file. It's being delivered from one president to another, working with the guidelines that is being put there by the deep government in the United States of America.
And coming up next, Mahsa Amini and Salman Rushdie, the controversial author. What do these two have in common? Find out when we return. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Chagos Archipelago, home of the Chagosians, Diego Garcia, the largest island in the archipelago, is now the location of a very large U.S. military base.
UK government give our island to the U.S. government to make a military base and just deported all the Chagosian people from their country, so they can't return back on the island.
Never.
But we are fighting. That's why we are fighting for the rights of return.
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. And on the question of self-determination, the legal advice we've received is actually the Chagossians were not and are not a people.
For me, it's time to move on and see what we can do for the Chagossian community to return back home.
There's no support from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
United Nations don't care about Chagossian people.
So
what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Is showing your hair a fundamental human right as a woman? Is fashion a tenet of democracy? Now, these are some of the things people in the West seem to value that are synonymous with Western democracies, or so we think. Dr. Marwa Osman is staying with us to continue the conversation. Now, Dr. Osman, through several U.S. presidents' administrations, Iran has seen a barrage of sanctions thrown at them. Many have argued that these sanctions have created and even fomented the protest we saw following Amini's death, that these U.S. sanctions have created financial hardship for the average Iranian. Some have even said that the point of these sanctions are deliberately aimed at the civilian population in hopes that the public will force regime change in Iran. If Iran was indeed a tinderbox, do these Amini protests have the capacity to perhaps become a color revolution?
Let's start by not taking the Western terminology for it and naming it the Amini protest, because the tragic death of Ms. Mahsa Amini was because of her chronic condition. She had a condition since she was 5 years old, and that's not me saying it, that's her own father saying it, and the coroner's office, after the forensic statement was issued last week, saying that Mahsa was suffering from a chronic disease, that and that the arrest had pushed her sentimentally to a point that she just collapsed, as we saw in the video, and she was taken to the hospital and sadly did not survive. So everything that's happening, it's now being basically categorized under the Mahsa Amini protest, but it's not the case. Now, talking about whether these protests are, or are these instigated protests are against the government or the people, no, it's against both the government and the people who support it, because I don't know if you saw Manila or of any of your audiences saw millions of Iranians who took the same week the protest started on a Friday, they took to the streets to stand by their revolution, by their government, and to stand by what they see as guidelines of their revolution and as points to be protected in the revolution. But the Western mainstream media won't show you that. I tweeted about it. I was bombarded with bots and with people calling me from names from Towelhead to Iranian puppet to saying that I'm being paid millions of riyals, and literally millions of Iranian riyals means less than a dollar. Because that's so sad, but it's funny at the same time, because they don't really know what they're talking about. But these unilateral punitive measures were made to make it hard to suffocate the Iranian public so they can protest and then protest turned into riots. But that never happened. They've been waiting for 40 years for this to happen, but it never happened because they don't really understand the mentality and the culture of the pro-revolution public in Iran. They don't understand this mentality because it's not based on a capitalist consumerism mentality like the West is. It's based on faith, it's based on piety, it's based on belief that Iran is a great nation and that it actually rose just like a phoenix from under the ashes in 1979. I mean, a country that's been suffocating under sanctions for the past 44 plus years was able to not only develop at the level of human and education and medicine, but also at the level of weapon making, at the level of technology, at the level of making use of the natural resources that they have. That says a great deal about the Iranian steadfastness and about the will to not bow down to any of these unilateral punitive measures.
In these protests, thousands of civilians have either been detained or arrested. Hundreds of people have died, dozens of them being police forces themselves. Dozens of journalists have also been arrested or detained. What do you make of this new level of violence breaking out there in Iran?
As I explained when we first started talking about the matter of riots and violence in the streets of Iran, I think that if it comes from Reuters, if it comes from the CNN, if it's coming from Sky News and Fox News, then you have to rethink that. One thing that I teach my students, because I am an assistant professor at the Faculty of Media, I teach my students something very important. When you get news, believe 20% of it, even if that news is coming from your own land. Why? Because you have to search and find resources on your own, especially because you are journalists, not as public. As public, I can't have the means to tell the entire public not to believe everything that they read or hear, but at least I can educate my students. And what I mean by that is not everything that you read, not everything that you see is actually accurate. I've been talking on a daily basis with my colleagues and friends in Iran, and it has been safe, it has been quiet. None of the propaganda that has been over the past month, it all receded, it all stopped. There's just one part of Iran, which is the northwestern part on the border with Iraq's Kurdistan, that's having major problems. Hence why we saw the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps bombing Iraq's Kurdistan, specifically the headquarters of three terrorist entities designated as terrorists by the United States of America, not only by Iran. So the United States of America does not accept them, but it condemns Iran when it targets them. But I can tell you again, obviously I'm against the incarceration of journalists, because freedom of speech and freedom of thought is vital. And I mean, it's crystal clear that if you don't have a voice, you have nothing. I mean, look at the numbers of journalist incarcerations in Turkey. Look at the numbers. I don't know if there are, like in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, I don't know if they have reporters. I'm being really honest with you. But in Iran, it was proven with evidence. I'm not trying to defend anyone, but it was proven with evidence that some, not all, some of the reporters were being pushed, paid, and basically controlled by embassies, Western embassies in Iran, to incite violence. Specifically, the reporter that started with the news about Mahsa Amini and said that she was brutally attacked and killed by the police. And as you saw, forensics said she had no bruises on her body, but she passed away because of the chronic disease that she was suffering from. When that is told, when that is heard by the public internally and externally, people get enraged, because people have a sense inside of them where they tend to like to defend other people when they are in hardships. They like to defend people who are being oppressed. But I don't know why in the West you only see that against Iran. You never see that against Palestine or Yemen or Somalia or Algeria or Libya. Or it's just against those who are designated as enemies of the United States of America. I'm not going to talk a lot about whether it is the truth or fake news or not. I will also say one thing. When you want to know what's going on in the country, you should talk to the public. You should maybe visit the country if you can financially do that. For example, this past summer, I visited Cuba. I went to Havana. I actually crossed the Atlantic for the first time in my life and went to Latin America, starting with Cuba, hopefully to have more friendships made and to understand both cultures and to coordinate at the level of global resistance against Western hegemony, against imperialism and neocolonialism. I had to go there for myself to see the level of suffocation that the American policies made in Cuba. But at the same time, I saw the steadfastness of the public. I saw that they have free healthcare, that they have free education, that they have free public transportation, that there is some poverty, but at the end of the day, no one is going to bed hungry, because there are kitchens in every neighborhood that give free food for the people who are in need. So when you see that a small country in comparison, for example, to Iran, it's not small, it's bigger than Lebanon, but compared to Iran, when that country has been steadfast for the past 60 plus years against Western hegemony, then you say that it's only natural for Iran to stand and face that same hegemony for 40 plus or 44 plus years. So it's not a matter of how they create instabilities in these sovereign nations, it's more of a matter how the public reacts to these instabilities and how they wisely take a step back and think more about the safety of their nation and about the safety and of their basically of their communities and about the future of their kids, and decide that no, we don't want to get involved in anything that is instigated by the West, that is will definitely bring down Iran to something similar to what happened in Syria, despite the fact that they failed even to do that in Syria. So go figure out, wonder, imagine what Iran still possesses in power to face such kind of hegemony and basically warfare against its sovereignty.
Dr. Marwa Osman, thank you so much for your insights today. The death of Mahsa Amini, no doubt tragic, whatever the cause. Around the world, a number of people die in police custody, sometimes as a direct result of police brutality, other times an untimely but natural death. But it's also important to discuss why some of these losses are a trigger or catch fire, like the BLM riots following George Floyd's death that roiled so many U.S. cities. There are always underlying reasons for discontent when mass protests like these erupt. And these conversations must be had to figure out the MO. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you again next week.